This is Spectator Radio. If you'd like to subscribe to The Spectator, you can get 12 issues for £12, as well as a £20 Amazon voucher. Just go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to a special edition of Spectator Radio. When the nuclear power plant was built on the coast of Cumbria in the 1940s, nobody had much idea about what to do with nuclear fuel once it had been spent. Today, that place is Sellafield, engaged in Europe's largest cleanup of nuclear waste, in what is perhaps the world's most complicated nuclear site. It's got its own police force, its own railway station, and its own unique set of challenges, one that seemed to baffle governments and private contractors alike. But with enough radioactive waste to keep it going for at least 100 years, it's something the government has got to learn to get right, and if it does, then there could be dividends to be harvested in Britain and perhaps internationally. So how best to go about it? I'm Fraser Nelson, and I'm joined by Gordon McKerron, who's professor at the University of Sussex and a nuclear power expert, by Jamie Reid from Sellafield, who was, until recently, Labour MP for Sellafield's home constituency of Copeland, and Tom Greatrex, head of Nuclear Industry Association, which is kindly sponsoring this podcast. Thank you all for joining me. So, Jamie, let's start with you. You've described Sellafield as one of the most complex engineering challenges on the planet. Why?
Well, this Sellafield was established after the end of the Second World War in order to create the materials for our atomic weapons program. As a result of doing that, other technologies presented themselves and became obvious, which we thought at that time, made a policy decision it would be useful to exploit as a country, nuclear power being one of them. So Sellafield became, with Calder Hall, the world's first commercial scale nuclear power station as well.
And this was back in 1956, at the very sort of start of the industry.
That's
so
right.
People were pioneering. They weren't quite sure what were they going to do with this material once it had been depleted. So you are in charge now of something that was built 60 years ago, when by definition the technology was at its most primitive.
That's right. But so even before we started generating power, and we haven't generated power on the Sellafield site since 2003, the popular misunderstanding that we're still a nuclear power facility, we were in the business of reprocessing nuclear materials. Now, that essentially means that you burn uranium, you then dissolve uranium, burnt uranium in nitric acid, and you remove from it its constituent parts, plutonium being one of them, which we needed for our weapons program. You're then left with a waste stream and a lot of recycled uranium as well. So we were doing that before we were generating power. Today, we're in the business of finalising our reprocessing mission. Reprocessing will end in 2020. And then our sole task will be on the environmental remediation of the Sellafield site, cleaning up the nuclear legacy, both civil and military.
Tom Greatrex, can you tell us how big Sellafield is in the scale of the British nuclear industry? Give us some idea for what proportion of the market this is.
Well, the UK civil nuclear industry employs around about 65,000 people. The vast majority are in the northwest of England and around West Cumbria, because you've got everything that's happening on site at Sellafield, which is worth huge amounts of money. There's a lot of public money that goes into it, but then...
And jobs?
And there's jobs, I think it's about 18,000, if you include the wider supply chain, and a lot of that supply chain, although it works primarily, or has worked primarily around Sellafield, also exports to other parts of the world and other parts of the country as well.
So Sellafield, the biggest single part then of our nuclear apparatus right now?
Well, it's the, Jamie said, it's the, and you quoted, it's the big challenge for, and the most complex site to deal with, probably in the world, I expect, certainly in the UK and in Europe.
I think to illustrate some of the scale more, Fraser, 11,500 people directly employed by Sellafield. Tom's right, there's a much greater aggregate number than that in the supply chain and with our business partners as well. It costs £2.1 billion a year to run the Sellafield site.
That's public money, isn't it?
That's money provided by the state, yeah. And it's also not just the biggest piece of the nuclear state in the UK. It's the biggest industrial facility in the UK bar none, and also the second largest construction site in the UK. A lot of what we do is making space for new buildings, for new missions, and building stores for the treatment and management of waste as well.
Gordon McKerron, the nuclear challenge seems to be one that people keep fundamentally underestimating. I mean, in Britain, but world over as well. I mean, the theme we see from here to Japan is one of cost overruns of these projects ending up far more complicated and expensive than people thought in the first place. It's too, even now, decades on, people seem to be keep being surprised about the cost and the complexity of this. So why is it so hard to get right?
Yes, I think we should distinguish between budget overruns for new nuclear power stations, which are endemic and have made serious doubts now about whether we can build much more nuclear power because financing of it is very difficult. The Sellafield issue is quite different. It's the legacy of what was, frankly, some very poor management, especially at the time when the nuclear weapons program was predominant. And the fact that we've kept on the reprocessing element, the separation of plutonium and uranium from spent nuclear fuel, has gone on a lot longer than was necessary because we don't any longer have a use for the plutonium. In fact, we have a problem now to decide how to dispose of it, whether to burn it or to treat it as directly as a waste. And of course, Sellafield is a huge industrial activity and a very important one. And I'm personally glad that we're spending $2 billion a year on it because the hazards there are potentially very great and they're very much in need of cleanup. But the fact is, the total bill is vast. It's tens of billions of pounds. And if we had managed things better in the past, we could have spent a lot of that money on other things. But having said that, I'm personally very pleased that the Nuclear Decommissioning Authority is so focused on cleanup. A problem for many years was that a previous company, British Nuclear Fuels, was both trying to earn money and clean up, and the government made it give priority to earning money. So the structure is now much better. The task is still huge.
But Jamie Reid, why have there been so many problems with private contractors here? I mean, a couple of years ago, the contract to decommission the dozen or so Magnox sites was torn up and taken back into government management, a hugely expensive process that cost the taxpayer more than £120 million. So it seems that when government calls in the private sector, things don't seem to go that much better.
Well, the sector has always used, and Sellafield's always used, private partnership, private contractors. I think on the issue of efficiency, Sellafield's operating more efficiently right now than it ever has done before. So just mentioned the annual funding that we received from government.
£2 billion, yeah.
Slightly over, 2.1.
It must make it, by the way, one of the most expensive projects the government's overseeing.
I would expect that's the case, yeah. And the mission at Sellafield, we expect on current rates to still be... We'll still be cleaning up Sellafield for a century.
Really?
So when we talk about how do we maximise the value from that, not just in terms of the sector and the industry, but for the UK economy as well, we're doing better and more with regard to that than ever before. So for instance, we've said to the government that we'll make £1.4 billion in efficiency savings by 2020. We're on track to do that. Last year, we delivered £600 million more work than we received funding for, and we've beyond 2020 pledge that we're going to deliver a further £1.4 billion in efficiency savings to the Exchequer as well. So what we've done most recently is enter into a framework contract, a partnership arrangement with four private sector companies. It's a 20-year framework contract worth billions of pounds, and they're going to be working with us and partnering us on achieving better value and achieving better progress on the Sellafield site so we can make that £2.1 billion a year, which we currently receive, go further.
Okay. So, Tom Greatrex, this is a problem which nuclear powers world over are facing with how to decommission. And it seems that it's not just Britain, but most countries do face cost overruns. There is a plant in France which is now 10 times running over budget. So what is it about this decommissioning project? We've known about this for 5 or 6 decades, but it still seems even now we're trying to learn about really how much it does cost, how much effort it does take to deal with spent nuclear fuel. And that, of course, impacts the economics of nuclear power in general, because you have to look at it in the round. So Jamie's talking about a century of decommissioning. So do you think it's fair to say that people have underestimated for quite some time how much time and money it would take to deal with nuclear fuel once it's been spent?
I think you need to make a distinction between the early projects and the early sites, so Sellafield, and James explained the complexity of that and the reasons for that, and the decommissioning aspect of building new power stations, because the funding for decommissioning is built into the structure of the financing for new power stations. So the Hinkley power station being built at the moment, for example, the decommissioning funding has to be accounted for in the overall contract for that. So there's a difference between the early activity where that wasn't planned. Mm-hmm. And partly it's a point you made at the start, because it was at the very start of that technology and that hadn't been thought through, that hadn't been considered in quite in the depth that things now are. So there is a distinction to be drawn between that. I think that the issue globally and in Europe as well as further afield is that there are things that we have learnt and developed and technologies we developed in the United Kingdom that have great applicability in other places that are starting to come towards having to look at how they're going to decommission their assets. So in Germany, for example, in 2022, if they finish using their current nuclear fleet in 2022, the plan is to start to decommission all of that fleet at once. Mm-hmm. That's something German industry hasn't yet done before, and so opens up a potentially quite significant opportunity for companies in the northwest of England.
Well, Germany as a country is moving quite fast away from nuclear energy. And I wonder if the lifetime costs of nuclear power seems greater now than it seemed 20 years ago. I mean, now you've got, is it right that nuclear power is now more expensive than solar or wind power?
That is the case. It wasn't the case at the time that Hinkley was agreed. Offshore wind was £140-£150 a megawatt hour at that point. Mm. And that's changed quite significantly in the last couple of years.
But because the energy situation globally is in a great state of flux right now.
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
Shale is changing it. The cost of solar is a lot less than we thought it would be a few years ago.
Yes, but none of these are a panacea. You know, solar, of course, when you look at what goes into solar panels and then how do you dispose of those and how you deal with that at the end of their lives, which are appreciably shorter than nuclear power plants. What you do also in relation to repowering wind farms, which the turbines and the plants will work for a certain period of time before they need to be refreshed. We don't really yet know quite how long some of the offshore ones in deeper water, which are bigger and produce more electricity, how long they can last for before they need to. So there's a whole range of different unknowns.
Much of what has been said I agree with, but I think the fundamental issue for new nuclear power is its staggeringly high upfront cost. The Hinkley Point project was extremely difficult to finance, and in the end we've only managed to finance it through two state-owned companies from France and China, because it wasn't possible to get the private sector to raise the enormous sums of money, 20 billion or so, that's necessary for this admittedly large, but still terribly expensive station. So although there may well be problems ahead with some of the renewable sources, the brute fact is that private capital is not very interested in investing in nuclear power. And with the exception of some parts of East Asia, China being the main one, Russia a little bit, most of the rest of the world is not very interested in nuclear power, fundamentally not because of the waste and decommissioning issue, but because of the financing and economic issue, which has, as we've just heard, got substantially worse over the last 10 years, much worse than the government, when it committed to a nuclear program, actually expected. And we should distinguish very clearly between that and the issue at Sellafield, where we're having to repair many, many years' worth of things that didn't go at all well. And it's true that some of the technology developed at Sellafield can be applied elsewhere, but a lot of it is to things like taking unknown bits of waste out of things that were dumped there many, many years ago. And that's important and it should be done, but it's expensive and it's not directly transferable to other people, because they haven't actually managed their waste in exactly the same way as we managed it rather poorly for many years at Sellafield.
Although some of the technology that's developed to be able to do that is certainly applicable elsewhere. So, for example, some of the remote handling robotics stuff, which has been pioneered in the civil nuclear industry in the UK, is now used extensively in other parts of the world. So it might not be doing exactly the same thing, but the application that's been developed certainly has got a wider application.
So a fortnight ago, 3 weeks ago, I was with the NDA in Norway, where the NDA signed a cooperation agreement with the Norwegian government with a view to helping it create its own NDA. They've done that because we've got the expertise. Mm-hmm. Similarly, our supply chain in West Cumbria develops techniques and technologies which it uses on the Sellafield site and then, for instance, is now selling into Fukushima. So there's great value in this, I think, for the UK economy in terms of GVA and GDP and a lot of the technical expertise. I think it's far more advanced than perhaps Gordon might appreciate, is genuinely scalable, genuinely unique and incredibly valuable to the UK.
And how scalable do you think it is?
I think the honest answer to that is it remains to be seen, because nuclear decommissioning as an industrial sector is still fairly fairly young, fairly new. So we need to understand better through experience how scalable this could be.
Yes, it is true that some of the technologies developed at Sellafield are saleable, are already sold, but relative to the amount of money being spent, it's relatively small. And the notion that we have a reputation that could allow us to become a world leader is quite difficult, because the last time we tried a major activity at Sellafield, which was a so-called mixed oxide fuel plant, where you mix plutonium with uranium to make fresh fuel, was frankly disastrous. And the French, for example, have been much better at doing that and have a much better international reputation. It doesn't mean that there aren't opportunities, but at the level of spend that we have to engage in at Sellafield, and I support the level of spend because it's important to reduce the hazard, if we were free to spend it elsewhere, would probably result in much greater opportunities. It's good that there are lots of skilled jobs, but the question is, what could we have done if we hadn't had to do this very large cleanup process instead? And, you know, some of Sellafield's activities have not actually been that successful, and the mixed oxide fuel plant was a classic case from the relatively recent past.
Well, actually, the issue with MOX is that MOX was very successful for a period of time. The main customer, though, was the Japanese industry, and that's where a lot of the work that MOX did came from. But then post-2011, post-Fukushima, and the changes in the Japanese industry for that time, and that we're still adjusting to, meant then that customer disappeared. So that was a real issue with MOX, rather than there being actually anything particularly wrong with the technology.
So, Tom, the problem you say was not anything to do with the technology. Is that a client pulled out? But Professor McCarran, doesn't this illustrate another factor? It's sometimes said of Sellafield that it is given just enough by the government to keep itself out of court, but not much more. Do you think that's a fair assessment? Do you think that it's not very well funded? Or do you think that it's given enough money to meet what the taxpayer can reasonably expect of it?
Well, I think government has given some protection to funding for Sellafield because it has been worried about the level of hazard that Sellafield represents. And I think the NDA has historically often said that it would be difficult to actually physically do much more work than is possible on this roughly $2 billion, sometimes a bit more, budget per year. The problem, I think, is if we could be geared up further, that quite a large proportion of the annual expenditure at Sellafield is what is often called in the trade hotel costs. In other words, just costs necessary to keep the site safe without actually doing much progress and decommissioning work. If it were possible to ramp up the level of expenditure with the skills and so on that would be required, it would actually mean that we could do the whole job rather cheaper, because we wouldn't have to keep repetitively every year incurring these so-called hotel costs. But having said that, Sellafield is a very cramped and very difficult site, and it is a very big challenge. I personally like the fact that government has taken back the contract that was previously given out to largely foreign firms to oversee the site, because I think it does work more efficiently if the company that has the site license, Sellafield PLC, actually has the responsibility itself. I think that is working better. I would like to see yet more being spent, but it does depend upon physical access, skilled people, companies that can offer the right technology to actually achieve it.
Jimmy Reid, the National Audit Office and others who looked at Sellafield, when they tend to report on it, they tend to come back saying there are lots of problems here, cost overruns, projects going wrong. And so if you look at the reports, it would seem as if Sellafield is struggling to do what the government expects of it. But do you think things have changed recently? And can you see a situation where you can change from a sort of narrative of cost overruns to a narrative of growth and expansion? And you were talking about even cost savings earlier on.
I think the pitch has changed significantly since the creation of the NDA. Prior to the creation of the NDA.
Which was when?
2004-05. Okay. I don't think that the UK paid the right kind of attention to its nuclear liabilities, which it needed to. And the NDA was a game changer in that. And then latterly, Gordon just put his finger on it as well, the creation of Sellafield Limited 3 or 4 years ago, the site license company to which now runs and operates a Sellafield site on behalf of the NDA. Not-for-profit organisation focuses purely on delivering the Sellafield mission, so remediating the high hazards and accelerating the cleanup. And we're doing that now in a way which the site has never seen. It's being done better, more efficiently, more quickly than ever before.
So, Tom Greatrex, can you tell us who else in the world is doing this well? When you look for best practice for the kind of work that Sellafield is doing, what countries stand out?
For example, in Jamie talked about Norway, also in Japan in the recent past, they've effectively set up an equivalent of an NDA. So the UK model that has been adopted in the last sort of 10, 15 years is something that lots of people have looked at quite carefully and seen a lot of advantages in doing it as they get towards a stage where decommissioning becomes much more significant than it has been, because they've got to the point at which reactors have stopped generating power and then need to be decommissioned. So this is, in some senses, quite a new industry. Mm-hmm. And it's an industry where it's just the reality of history that we're at the forefront of it and have been at the start of it.
And just, if I'm being Fraser, building upon what Thomas just said there, a lot of what we do at Sellafield is the first time in the world that that particular technology is being utilised or deployed, or that the project's being managed. Now, of course, there's some similarities around the globe, but you really won't find a nuclear site as unique as Sellafield anywhere in the world. 2 square miles. Anything like it in equivalent terms in the US would be in 250 square miles of desert. So Sellafield is a very, very uniquely British site, and the solutions that we develop and apply there really are different to what you might apply elsewhere.
And also, in terms of a scale, Jamie, I mean, you used to be MP for Copeland until fairly recently. Sellafield hires most people in Copeland. I can't think of any other company that would report for, 60% of the jobs there?
Yeah, almost 60%, 58.8% of all economic activity directly and indirectly in Copeland is as a result of Sellafield's activities. In neighbouring Allerdale, it's around about 25-28% as well, yeah.
So absolutely huge then.
It's huge, and all the more reason to develop a proper way of sustaining the economic model which Sellafield represents. That's why it's got to be, I think, in that part of the world where I still live and raise my family, and I think always will. We need to take Sellafield out of the picture. It's an economy which is very heavily dependent upon the public sector. Now, I think that's something which isn't healthy, and the need to grow the private sector there, I think, is overwhelming and obvious. And if we can do that through the nuclear industry, I think that's something that we should seek to do.
Right. But Gordon McCarry, isn't that the problem? That for years we've been trying to involve the private sector in nuclear energy, and things seem to be going the other direction. I mean, in January, Hitachi scrapped plans to build 2 new plants, I think Toshiba. They recently abandoned plans to build a plant in Cumbria. And this is for new energy generation, of course, as opposed to dealing with spent nuclear fuel. But does it seem to you as if after 2 or 3 decades of trying, that no government, not just in Britain, but anywhere in the world, is really succeeding in drawing in the private investment that in theory might have been possible?
Well, it's certainly possible to get private companies to be engaged. What's really difficult is to find private investors who actually think nuclear is any kind of a good bet, because it's extremely expensive. It carries with it very high commercial risks, even if we ignore any potential safety risks. And worldwide investment communities really will only go into nuclear power with very heavy state guarantees. That's not entirely new. What's new is that the actual costs of new nuclear have actually escalated continuously now for quite a long period in a way that nobody fully expected, but which has meant nuclear has suffered at the hands of especially renewable energies, which have been heading rapidly in the opposite direction, in other words, towards cost reductions rather than cost increases. But just one thing to come back to what Jamie was saying, and I agree with, that many of the challenges in Sellafield are absolutely unique. And it is that uniqueness which actually limits the extent to which Sellafield can become a major source of export income. It can be some, but many of the challenges are so specific to the UK that's a problem. Let me give you one brief example. When a new evaporator had to be installed as part of the reprocessing complex, a number of bridges had to be demolished temporarily within the site actually to get the evaporator in. Well, if you have this, as Jamie says, 250 times bigger site, you don't have that kind of problem. So some of the costs at Sellafield are precisely because of the uniqueness and the fact that it's an immensely cramped site. And as it's rightly said, in the United States, there are some similar problems because of the military origins of the technology, but they can be managed more easily because the sites are even more remote and much bigger.
So Jamie, Gordon's saying that Sellafield, because it's so unique, this is a bit of an impediment when you think about how it can grow. I mean, it's difficult to say our problems are the same as those of France and Germany and Japan, therefore we'll take their business. If our problems are very different, doesn't that put a limit on how much Sellafield can really export?
Well, it remains to be seen. So I think Sellafield Limited as an organisation is tasked with cleaning up the Sellafield site. We aren't the kind of organisation that's going to start exporting or selling our capability overseas. That's not what we're about. That's not we ought not to be in that game. But
what about importing fuel from other people?
From around the UK, we take the fuel from the existing Magnox fleet and we treat that at the Sellafield site. But taking fuel from overseas, that market no longer exists, so that won't be happening anymore. But in terms of the partnerships that we build with the supply chain and the capability that they can then create, they are the people, like those that we've just signed for a long-term partnership arrangement with. They're the kind of organisations that can take the, if you like, the Sellafield kite mark, mm-hmm. And export that capability overseas. Now, that's very, very clearly obvious.
Our members in the Nuclear Industry Association are the companies that have developed some of that IP, some of that expertise, some of that capability, which is then, it is being applied in different places around the world already. And if you look at the European decommissioning market, look in Germany, in Sweden, and in a few years' time further in France, there will be a lot of decommissioning activity happening where some of that capability and some of that first development of some of that technology can be applicable. And we've already seen that is happening. And that's an important aspect of the industry, which has been included in the sector deal that the industry have agreed with the government, for example, to look at ways in which we can make more of what we've got.
And Tom, can you give us an idea of the size of a decommissioning market versus the new energy market? Can you see a time where the decommissioning almost becomes bigger?
Well, I mean, the Committee on Climate Change report from the other week, the IPCC report, the work that the International Energy Agency have done, all demonstrate that if you're going to get to that sort of low carbon mix in the future, there's an element of firm power, and element of that firm power will almost certainly come from nuclear into the future. So it's not about something which is going to stop or should stop either. That's been re-emphasised in the recent past. But the reality is that we are getting to a stage now where there will be decommissioning activity happening in parallel with new build and continuing operations. That hasn't quite been the case until relatively recently in the UK, and that's going to be the case in lots of other countries around the world. So you can see that potential market opening up alongside other things that are happening in the industry.
Gordon McKerra, and Theresa May recently committed the government to going net zero in greenhouse gas emissions by 2050. It remains to be seen if her successor will stick by that pledge, but he probably will. What implications does that have for nuclear power in Britain?
It's not really clear what implications. One of the things that the committee has emphasised very strongly is that it's extremely important that we commercialise and use carbon capture and storage technology, which will allow us to use fossil fuels in a relatively clean way in relation to these targets, while still providing the firm power that the other discussants are saying is important and with which I agree. So I don't think it actually is necessarily a green light for a lot more nuclear. Government may try new funding schemes that will make nuclear fundable, but bear in mind that the timescales are extremely long. We announced more nuclear power back in 2006, 2008, and Hinkley Point might be ready by 2025 if we're lucky. So it's not a rapid solution to any of these issues. The other thing to say is that the people who are now most active in trying to sell their nuclear technology are the Russians and now increasingly the Chinese. And there are some very difficult security as well as potentially safety issues about accepting technology from those companies, given that others, Westinghouse, Toshiba, and to a significant extent Hitachi, have done it very badly. And there is difficulty in the international supply chain in that area. So it's a possibility that nuclear might revive somewhat in this country, but it's difficult to imagine it happening very quickly.
I think in terms of understanding the full economic impact and value of the nuclear industry, though, we actually, if this makes sense to listeners, we need to kind of separate out the nuclear element from the industry, from all of the other skills which are inherent within it as well. So, for instance, at Sellafield, massive engineering capability, massive construction capability, cybersecurity, huge capability, and other digital skills, as well as project management, et cetera, as well, which are all very, very, very valuable commodities and services which can continue to benefit the UK's
economy.
Cybersecurity,
can you say a bit more about that?
I wouldn't want to, by definition of the subject, I wouldn't want to say too much about it, Fraser, but it's certainly something which we are. The nuclear industry in general is exceptionally good at. Sellafield is particularly good at it. And we're looking all the time at what assets and skill bases we have with a view to seeing how we can maximise the value of those, not for Sellafield Limited per se, but for the NDA, for the UK taxpayer.
Right. And what can you see Sellafield looking like in sort of 10, 15 years' time? This is the biggest commercial site in Britain, the second largest construction site in Britain. What's its future like over the medium term?
We're investing millions in skills and training in the local area, including in secondary schools and specialist technical education and training as well. And I would like to think that in the future, Sellafield Limited as an employer will be significantly less significant than that 60% we talked about before. There'll be a much bigger private sector in the shape of the supply chain around that within the local economy, creating more jobs than is currently possibly the case, working on the Sellafield mission, not necessarily working on the Sellafield site. So I think the prospects there in terms of achieving growth are genuinely exciting and significant, not just for the area of Cumbria, but for the UK.
Jamie Reid, Gordon McKernan and Tom Greatrex, thanks very much for joining me. And thanks to Cindy Yu, who produced the podcast.